protected from today's elements, depending on where you are in the state. We certainly have had our fair share of winter weather in the last several weeks. Today, you know, we're going to start off with a discussion about workforce development, and we're going to talk about job needs in the future, supporting the green transportation sector. We need to prepare for cross-panel discussions. We had a meeting with the Just Transition Working Group on February 23rd. Also, we want to discuss, you know, walk through the advisory panel recommendation template that we have been asked to fill out. And basically, we're going to start today with the first of those templates, and it'll be on electrification. And we will follow through with additional sessions dealing with smart growth and land use and public transportation, as well as fuels and market-based policies. We will discuss the need for additional expert input into the deliberations that we have had and that we plan on having. And we also want to talk about future research and future expert panels that we think that are worth certainly providing in the future. And then lastly, we want to discuss, you know, kind of getting into a rhythm for upcoming meetings and next steps as we prepare to provide the recommendations from this group once they're adopted, and providing them to the CAC, which as of now, I believe is mid-March. So why don't we start through today's meeting procedures. So we'll go through and just a quick reminder that if people are not speaking, they really should be on mute. We encourage everybody to participate. You know, please make sure that when you do participate that you not only unmute, but that you activate your camera so that we can see you. And also, you know, we will not necessarily be muting individuals on the panel for discussion, but we'll ask the chair to call on members individually, and at which time, if you're muted, please, you know, unmute yourself. If there are any technical problems, please contact Jesse. His email is on the slide. And again, like I said, we strongly encourage dialogue during today's discussions. And please let us know, you know, what's on your mind, what we can do moving forward to enhance the deliberations that have taken place. And certainly, please feel free to comment on any aspect of today's deliberations that you feel require elaboration. Next slide, please. So we're going to do a quick roll call here. I'm going to go down the list. So next slide. So Commissioner will be joining us shortly. Jared, I see you. Good morning. I think I saw Paul flash in and out.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Demetrius?
Good morning. Good
morning. Steve? Steve Fitch?
Steve's here.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
Albert? Is Albert joined? Can we know if he's muted?
It looks like Albert has not joined us, actually.
Okay, thank you. Kendra?
Yes, Kendra's here. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm sure you're having a busy day as well.
A little bit.
Yes. LG?
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning, sir. Renee?
Renee.
Haven't seen Renee. Okay. I'm trying to look across the top here, but I can't see everybody. Pori?
Yes. Hi. This is Pori. I'm here. How are you?
Hi. Hope you're doing well. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
John? John Samuelson?
Haven't seen John either.
Okay. Nick?
Here.
You there, Nick?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Point of personal privilege, congratulations on your forthcoming role in your new endeavor.
Thank you.
Very happy for you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Kareem?
I'm here. Sorry.
That's good. Thank you. Julie, I think I saw you. Julie, you're
there? I'm here from snow in New York City.
Yeah. Good. It's about time New York City got some snow. You know, we've been saving it upstate for way too long. Craig? Craig Turner?
It looks like Greg hasn't joined us either.
Okay, I think I saw Nancy.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And Bob Zarillo.
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Good.
So, next slide, please. So, you know, the Just Transition Working Group, as many of you may be aware, includes 17 members, and they represent vast interests from industry, from labor, environmental justice communities, energy, and workforce. You know, the CLCPA charges that group with any number of tasks, some of which include identifying energy-intensive industries and related trades, as well as avenues to maximize the skills in the new energy economy. Obviously, you know, as we move from certain types of fuels, that there needs to be retraining and repositioning of certain types of jobs. And, you know, there's a number of things that they have identified as issues. They're also working on, you know, where these sites, you know, that generate electricity, where they may be closed as a result of transition to clean energies, and any issues and opportunities that are presented by energy sites that might be closed or otherwise, you know, changed, modernized. And so as we start to prepare recommendations, we need to kind of integrate, you know, our recommendations, our issues, our opportunities, you know, and see how they work with the related energy-intensive trade-exposed entities. We need to include workforce development for trade-exposed entities into our deliberations. Obviously, we have been focused on and, you know, trying to, you know, work through issues related to disadvantaged communities, as well as underrepresented segments of the population. And then we need to try and work with the Just Transition Working Group on how we can minimize carbon leakage risk of any potential carbon policies. Jared, can I turn it over to you to kind of discuss, you know, some of the work that's going on with the Just Transition Work Group and their principles, and discuss the TAP meeting that we had with this group on the 23rd? I mean, sorry, we have with this group on the 23rd?
Sure thing, Ron. You know, I'm not really intimately familiar with the work of the Just Transition Working Group. We have scheduled a meeting with them to get their input on strategies to be considered by this panel. So, you know, what strategies should we be, you know, thinking about as far as, you know, building the workforce that, you know, can support the transition to clean transportation? You know, what are the job opportunities? What are, you know, really the you know, business opportunities as well? And what are the opportunities to ensure that our communities, you know, benefit from that transition? So, we scheduled a meeting for the 23rd with the Just Transition Working Group, and we'd like to put together a delegation of this panel to meet with them. You know, so far we've identified, I think Kendra has stepped up and volunteered to participate in that, but we're interested in you know, who else would like to be part of that conversation. So, you know, at this point we're looking for volunteers for that meeting.
Depending on the time of the meeting, Jared, I can volunteer. We just completed a green jobs report that has some best practices reflecting our experience with our Solar Uptown Now training program in Harlem, and just some national best practices. So just depending on the time, I think I can do that.
That would be great. I think it's going to be in the morning, somewhere between 9 and 11.
On the 23rd?
Correct.
I can do it. My schedule is the worst. Thank you. I can do 9 to 11. I'm going to just block that up now.
Thank you. LG, you were raising your hand. Is that to comment or participate?
No, where Kareem goes, I go. So, there you yes. Go. I would like to volunteer, yes.
Yeah, likewise.
Was that Paul? I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Picture.
Please, thank you.
Okay, we've got four volunteers, Paul, Kendra, Kareem, and LG. I think as part of this, you know, we want to talk about some of the discussion questions that have been posed, and I can run through them, and then we can, you know, talk about them depending on how people want to proceed. But basically, as we go through, you know, the conversation, we really need to think about what the workforce opportunities are that will be created by transitioning to a green transportation system. You know, what are the challenges that will be created by the system and its impacts on labor? What specific types of workforce skills and development training would be needed? How is this going to change the, you know, manufacturing and shipping logistics aspect of businesses as they, you know, retool and adjust to different types of production in support of a green economy? And, you know, what do we need to put in place to make sure that New Yorkers specifically benefit from such a shift and that they're not left out? Not only the workers, but also making sure the businesses can pivot and they have the resources necessary so that they also can transition to, you know, the new green economy, and especially a green transportation system. Because, you know, again, there will be a lot of changes in terms of how the power grid and, you know, other sectors will work. But how do we, you know, we've talked about the very aggressive goals for electrifying and or other clean zero emission strategies for fleets. How does that all work in terms of, you know, the transportation system, not only in terms of the production and procurement of vehicles, but the actual, you know, whether it be rail, air, highways and bridge, you know, the actual infrastructure that's necessary to support that. And then, you know, how can we work cooperatively to make sure that as we're developing these opportunities, that we're also aligned with other training opportunities that are being put forth in other sectors so that we have the ability to cross-train and make sure the availability of workers is there to meet the demand moving forward. So I guess I'll put people on the spot, I guess. In terms of shipping and logistics, what do we think we should be discussing in terms of making sure that we're planning far enough ahead to ensure the not only the availability of goods, but also making sure there's no disruption in the supply chain? Anybody want to comment on that?
I guess I probably would be appropriate for me to speak on that issue. I mean, when it comes to issues such as training and workforce development, you know, we have a challenge currently with not only a driver shortage in the industry, but also a diesel technician shortage. And so as we are working towards the transition toward electric vehicle or you know, lower emission vehicles, natural gas fueled vehicles, there is a training component there for our technicians to ensure that they're equipped with the appropriate knowledge to work on those vehicles. So that's a really a big piece that we have to focus on within the industry to ensure that we're able to keep those trucks running and we have a workforce that is trained to do so. I think that the same challenge holds true with drivers, although I would We just had this conversation recently in house as we were talking about workforce development issues, that the shift to greener, cleaner vehicles may actually help encourage younger generations to look at the trucking industry as an option. You know, we know that that age group tends to hold, you know, social responsibility and environmental initiatives in high regard. And so as the industry is making adjustments, that could be something that becomes attractive to them. So it's a challenge to ensure that we're prepared for whatever changes in operating those vehicles may bring. But there could be an opportunity there in terms of attracting the younger generation to the industry, because the equipment is going to be cleaner. The industry is going to be reducing their carbon footprint, so that could be attractive to them.
Yeah, I would imagine that it would also attract people who are in various technology sectors today that haven't thought about transportation as a field. But the more that we become dependent upon technology, such as electrification and other clean fuels, it's almost like video game productions. We're going to need a lot of qualified individuals who can write code and do programming and do error checking.
Yeah, and to be truthful, that's a lot of what we focus on when we do go in. Because we go in today, we work with both these programs and other educational institutions. They're trying to really change the image of the industry. You know, it's not the days of old where you are turning wrenches. There is certainly still a lot of that occurs, but even today's trucks, there's a high component of the technology that requires computers to diagnose what's going on, or even to make software upgrades and things of that nature. So that is a big piece that we talk about now, that this is much more technical field than it once was. And to your point, trying to really show that this could be something that's attractive to folks that may not have originally considered a diesel technician or a truck technician as a career of choice. Really the same thing will hold true for drivers. I mean, we do get a somewhat related, I think, to the overall goal of GHG reduction is also the shift towards automation. And there's a concern that always comes up and says, well, are we going to displace jobs if we move towards an automated industry? And my opinion is not necessarily, because I think what we will see, like, that is not a shift that happens overnight. That's going to be a transition. There's a lot of components that have to come into play to get to a fully automated environment. And so if we're moving that direction, I think what we start to see is drivers that are retiring or leaving the industry, we just don't look to replace those particular positions. I don't think it's a situation where we would be doing a large scale, you know, firing, if you will, of employees because of moving towards automation. So I think it's like, as one is trending up, the other starts to trend down. But that is another piece that it's going to require training. We need to ensure that those drivers that are in the field are prepared and have the understanding of what not only is in today's trucks, but what's potentially coming down the road, whether it's electric or automated or even safety technologies that are built into these vehicles today. So there is a massive training component, both on the technician side, but also the driver side, as we're talking about these newer vehicles.
I'd like to add, I know my father actually works in this industry, repairing cars and trucks and things like that. He started in New York, but he relocated to Florida. And there is a lot of concern from their perspective, just how EV vehicles will impact their industry. And so I don't know if there's some type of way to, you know, think about that transition and start the training now. And even if they're technical schools or high schools that do this kind of work, that introduce students to these jobs, like starting having those kinds of training and ways to develop retention lines early in the process, just to, you know, to Kendra's point, it's not going to happen immediately, but build in some type of safety net for awareness through high schools and technical schools and community colleges might be a way to kind of incorporate the educational side of it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's one of those things where we need to be proactive. We know that it's coming. We may not have a specific timeline in terms of when we're going to see a proliferation of these vehicles in the market, but we do need to make sure that anyone that is associated with the industry, whether it's the drivers or the techs or even those in operations, are prepared for that. So I agree. I think the training needs to start today. We do work there. There are a number of schools in New York, like I said, there's a number of BOCES schools across the state that do both CDL training, both from students as well as adult education. And they do also offer, currently it's diesel technician, but I think we have to just change it to heavy duty vehicle technician because we know that that's going to be changing. But we can start with those schools, and we're making a lot of contacts with them now just as part of our overall workforce development initiative. So those contacts, I think, can prove to be useful as we start really looking at down the road how we need to be preparing these individuals for what's coming.
All right, Steve, if I could pick on you for a minute. I know that you work in an industry that went through an enormous change with the clean air requirements. You know, all of a sudden engines became very complex, very electric. I don't mean electric in the sense of propulsion, but a lot of components, even to the point where people couldn't work on them anymore. And that must have been a big change for your workforce. Do you have any insights based on that transition that you think, you know, move forward into the realm that we're discussing? Steve, you're muted.
Oh, there it is. So thank you for the opportunity. You know, the transition, like you just described, was very interesting because engine technology, internal combustion engine technology, has changed so dramatically over the years. And seeing that this whole issue around emissions was becoming more and more of a factor, there was a tremendous amount of energy put into advancing internal combustion engine technology to give it more of a fuel efficient and reduced emissions context, so that people would be able to, you know, understand that we're moving in that direction. So the technology that got added to, you know, conventional engine tech is tremendous. The number of computers that are on board your vehicle to measure timing and to measure, you know, the atmospheric conditions and adjust the engine to that became a real training issue for technicians. But the difference, I think, here is that it was, I'd say, additive technology to what was already well known and understood. You still had valves and, you know, timing chains and, you know, all of the other things that, you know, mechanics have been used to over years and years, and now you're adding some of these additional technologies to it. Whereas what we're talking about now with electrification is a total disruption, if you will, to what's going on in that industry. And I can give you, from my current job now with AAA, another perspective on this, and that is just this past weekend, we got a call for a Tesla vehicle that had run out of charge on the side of the road. So we sent a tow truck to pick up the vehicle to take it to a place where it could get charged. And when the driver got there, had no idea how to connect up the vehicle. I mean, in this case, there was no, you know, you're not even talking about making repairs to the engine and all that. This was just as simple as picking up the vehicle to put it on the flatbed to move it. And what I'm seeing is that there's going to be a tremendous transition because even as we make mandates and sell only electric vehicles by the year, say 2035, there's still going to be a lot of vehicles on the road that have mixed levels of technology. And so this training issue that we are going to have to deal with is going to be extremely huge. We're going to have people with the current knowledge and experience, but also be comfortable with the new technology and electrification of vehicles as they come on the market. And I think to Kendra's point, and Kareen's, the whole shift towards electrification is also a shift towards electrical knowledge. The mechanics are going to have to understand programming and logic, and they're going to have to be as adept with computers as they are with wrenches. So the whole idea of what it's going to take, you know, to maintain the fleet once we begin to make this transition is a lot different. And so I agree it's got to start with the schools and the training and what we're doing. Even with AAA, we're engaged with high school classes that are doing this kind of work and helping them to understand the transition that's coming.
I think nationally, to Steve's point about education, our math scores just aren't on par. And if we're asking students to be prepared for these types of jobs, they're not equipped. And what we've experienced with our solar training programs is we've had to remediate a lot of under-skilled and folks who don't have, you know, algebra, good, strong understanding of algebra and those kinds of things. And so if we are to, you know, think holistically, the school education system that in many ways leaves a number of students of color behind can't do that, especially if, you know, those industries are of those, you know, the folks who are doing the mechanics or the driving, et cetera, if there are a lot of people of color in those places and they've not been required to be more math and more science focused, the education system is going to have to change dramatically to service them better.
Yeah, and Corinne, I think along those same lines, you know, and I'm trying to figure out the fairest way to phrase this, but often what we see is individuals that choose to come into the technician field or into commercial driving, for example, are individuals that either don't want to go to college, or maybe aren't prepared to go to college. And so now we're going to be asking those same individuals to have, you know, those more, I guess, higher level skills in terms of the technology and the ability to, as was already pointed out, code and write these programs or be able to diagnose these programs. And so it is a shift because we're going to be asking more of these students than we are today, and taking, I don't want to say taking an option away from them, but, you know, these are students that are choosing these fields simply because they may not have either that level of interest or just, you know, don't have the skill set currently to go that direction.
Yeah, and I think even beyond that, as vehicles become self-driving, that's a whole industry that is in play to impact folks from a job perspective.
So, comment a little bit on the electrification nature from a technological standpoint and automation specifically. I know these appear to be extremely disruptive technologies, right? And maybe replacing a light duty electric vehicle for an existing internal combustion engine vehicle, a new sale, is game changing, and I agree. But we have to kind of put everything into context. The career is 30 years long, and we're talking about the year 2020 today. 2035 will be when we can expect maybe one in two new vehicles to be electrified or fully electric in the light duty sector. If we start looking at what that means for year 2050 for the entire fleet in the U.S., because we're going to be introducing in 2035, 7.5 million electric vehicles on the road. And we're going to be displacing out of a total fleet of what, maybe 270 million? If you run the numbers, year 2050, you're still looking at over 80 or 85% of internal combustion engines still on the road. So we don't need to retrain immediately. We need to start thinking about it, start thinking what the directions are. But it's not that the shift is happening in 3 years or in 5 years and we're not prepared for it, because there's still going to be a huge bulk. I mean, these are extremely worthy conversations, and we need to have them to be placed in the right direction and be ready, so that way we're not caught behind the eight ball on this one. But same thing a little bit with automation. One day we will have self-driving robo-taxis in New York City, but we are so far away from that. When I look at the R&D right now, what's happening in the world of automation, we're still trying to figure out how to use these technologies. And if anything, we're not replacing the driver yet. You go and you see a vehicle that's running out on the road. It actually has a remote driver that is outside monitoring it on a computer screen somewhere else. So the jobs are shifting, and we got to track them. But I don't know that we're essentially contracting the workforce just yet, but we're starting to see all the right indicators that we should be having these conversations. I guess my point is, I think we have a little bit longer time horizon to think of how to solve the problem, and maybe that affects some of the solutions of how we brainstorm.
I agree with you, Dimitri. I think the reality too, though, is it's going to happen in cycles. And so someone who's currently employed right now and has been in the field maybe 10, 15 years, you know, that level of transition in terms of how they might be impacted may not be the same. But say a student that's 10 years old, 15 years old, how are we preparing them for what might be that field for them? You know, like how do we fill in those gaps in math and science, et cetera, so that the 10-year-old, the kindergartner, whatever, they're being prepared so that they're not, you know, whereas before they may not have had the skills that would be required, as Kendra was stating. We know now that that's going to be the change. So how does the education system or whatever, technical, community college, whatever, how are they going to start transitioning so that that 10-year-old, that 15-year-old, who will become the 30-year-old, the 40-year-old in that industry is prepared? That's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Along the lines of where Corrine and Demetrius were just going, I do want to ask Bob Zerillo a question, because one of the things I see here is, in terms of the workforce and workforce development and availability of employees, is there's always kind of like an iceberg effect. You know, you see the piece at the top, but below the surface, those that are maybe not in a position to pay as well as larger trucking companies, maybe airports and aviation-related businesses, they will pick off employees from, say, public transportation systems. And my biggest concern is that one of our goals is to ensure that we have a strong and vibrant public transportation system throughout the state. Bob, what are your thoughts on the impacts of being able to compete in a green economy and while protecting, you know, preserving the ability to hire individuals who can work on new technology vehicles, electric vehicles? Because I do see there's a cherry picking, for lack of a better term, within the sector.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Ron. And I was going to just add to Kendra's comments earlier that, you know, the public transit industry is, you know, fairly similar in many respects to the trucking industry. We compete for some of the same drivers and mechanics. It's certainly a concern. The change in the workforce, the training that's got to take place, the competition for jobs. Public transit, there's 75,000 public transit workers in New York State right now. And if we move on our goal of increasing the availability and accessibility of public transit as part of our effort here, certainly transit service would hopefully grow in the future. And you know, those jobs are in New York. They're not somewhere else creating supplies or manufacturing products that we use in New York. The competition is certainly an issue. There's competition now. Some of our transit systems in less dense areas are having trouble competing for bus drivers right now, with the trucking industry paying higher rates at some point. So a lot of competition there. Certainly the training that folks have talked about already is important through many industries, including public transit. There's the other, economic benefit that we've talked about in earlier meetings, and, you know, the impact that MTA and the other transit systems have on purchasing equipment and supplies that are many times built or assembled in New York State, and those jobs are here too. So training those workers to produce the materials and supplies for the greener buses and greener subway vehicles, is certainly a training opportunity and a job. First, a jobs creation opportunity, and then a training needs as well. So, I'm not sure how we address the competition between the different types of the different modes on looking for the same types of individuals. Other than grow the pie, if we. Start early. I think as Corrine mentioned, it start early that these jobs are in New York State. Oftentimes they're union jobs, so they're high paying and good benefits and long lasting. with protections, and those are important things for careers. And also, start early and grow our state as well. You know, if we're shrinking around the state in population, it's going to be difficult to grow the kind of jobs needed. So, just a couple of thoughts there. I wish I had a better answer to your question, Rob, but it's certainly an important one.
I think Kareem raised a really valuable point. Part of what we're trying to do here through these initiatives is to ensure that, you know, everybody benefits. And the point that I took away from her comments was that, you know, we're asking individuals who may not have the ability, the access, the desire to go to advanced educational levels to, you know, basically change kind of their trajectory. They may not have the math skills because of the schools that they attend. How do we actually, you know, lift up, you know, individuals that might be challenged in terms of, you know, availability of quality education, and or, you know, they really were never planning to go into a higher level of education? That seems like one of the critical paths to make sure that, you know, everybody in all communities can benefit.
Hey, Ron, it's Jared. I just want to jump in, on one point that Demetrius raised. And Demetrius, I think you were talking about sort of what's the business as usual, phase in of electric vehicles. And as sort of a sneak peek at what we're going to be talking about 20 minutes, you know, we really need to accelerate that to meet the goals of the legislation. So we're going to be talking about policies that, you know, accelerate that transition so that by 2035, we're seeing 100% electric vehicle sales. And with the goal that by 2050, you know, virtually all cars are going to be electrified. There'll be very few left on the road that are still internal combustion. And then there's a similar transition for trucking. So, you know, we just, as part of our strategies here, this transition needs to be accelerated. So we need to think about how do we accelerate that workforce transition, you know, at the same time.
Okay. LG, were you trying to say something?
No.
Okay. So, again, I don't want to, you know, cut off the conversation, but I do think we're going to need to move on to other agenda items. But I do want to, you know, do a last call here to see if anybody has anything they want to offer that hasn't spoken. But also to underscore that the challenge really isn't so much the technology, but it is providing the training and technical assistance to individuals so that they can all benefit and move along throughout the process as we transition to these new green technologies.
Ron, this is if I may just make one quick mention of one ray of hope here. The New York Power Authority for the past several years has run a program to support STEM education in EJ school systems that are in environmental justice communities. And so it's really getting exactly at Kareen's point that there needs to be a recognition that the fundamental skills, whether people are going on to college or going into these, you know, very technically driven jobs, we have to reach children now because they're going to be the workforce that we're going to depend upon in the future. And I just would recommend that someone get in touch with the folks at DIPA, because it really is a very good program and has the sort of the bones on which you could expand a statewide program.
That's an excellent point. Thank you. Was not aware of that, but I am aware of the state's effort in STEM, and it's one of the things we'll need to look at as we move forward, engaging, you know, not only NYPA and other agencies that do this, but also State Education Department. Any other comments on this topic before we move?
Yeah, Ron, this is Puri. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Yes, hi. I heard quite a bit of discussion on public transit and MTA, etc. One of the things that I just want to tell you that we do at the MTA is massive training programs. So we have trainings ongoing at all times. So we do have as we went from diesel vehicles to hybrid buses and now going on to electric buses. I mean, the training started way before the buses were, even when they were piloting. So the current workforce gets trained. The other thing that continuing on to the next things, and it's not just the electric vehicles. We deal with a lot of energy efficiency equipments. We work with NIPA. NIPA helps us do trainings. So it's for anything and everything that relates to energy efficiency, environmental impact, climate adaptation, even resiliency. And as we put in new resiliency measures, we actually have them trained. We have green doors in our tunnels and subways. I mean, those things really need to be closed, opened and closed within minutes, literally. And we have people trained, we have people who come into those jobs. And so that's the ongoing training within the MTA. The other thing is that I have noticed running the MTA's environmental and energy groups at the headquarters, one of the things that I've noticed that we are getting a lot of young people interested in coming to work for public transit. So I don't know, somebody mentioned, the people in the private sector taking from public sector workforce. It's kind of what I'm seeing is quite opposite. It's sort of like those young people who don't want to drive, fossil fuel cars anymore. Those are the ones that want to come and work in public sector. I have environmental scientists. I have, energy specialists working with me, young people straight out of college. So they're very interested. And all of our current energy efficiency related work, whether it's electrification, whether it's electric infrastructure, whether it's, equipment replacement, renewable energy, however we look at it, it's very, very data intensive. So, I have no clue how to manipulate data, but I have my entire staff who knows how to do that, and they're all young people. The third thing I did want to mention is that we do work with the universities. In fact, in 2 weeks' time, I'm actually going on to a CUNY organized some 25 or 12 campus virtual event where they want to know the kind of jobs, kind of trainings, and where we are going with the MTA so that they can prepare. So it's for students, and it's kind of a straight interaction with students. And in addition to all of us at whoever can mentoring at universities, we do a lot of lectures. We do a lot of guest lectures at various universities within New York, and now it's getting even better because it's getting virtual. So we are very much engaged at the college level with letting students know where what do they need to do. I mean, and most of these folks are majorly interested. They initiate these, and we kind of go along with them. So I just kind of wanted to mention that a lot of this is happening, and big public sector organizations like ourselves are very involved. And it's not just the MTA. I know that in New York City, the mayor's office, the DOT, the DEPs are very, very involved with universities and colleges and even high schools. I mean, I personally get involved with high school students from 7th grade up, and having them understand what is it that we do, what are the opportunities, and where the world in a reduced carbon base footprint should be going, and what are we doing to go along in that direction. So a lot of that is happening, and like I said, at the MTA, we are pretty well organized with all of this training, new recruitments, etc. Just wanted to mention that kind of as a comment, I guess.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, I'm sorry, Corinne, do you want to have the last word?
Yeah, Corinne's finally talking. I also want to lift up, I know someone mentioned that these are really good union paying jobs. Just I'd be remiss if I didn't mention just the racial issues within unions, and that there aren't the same level of opportunities for communities of color or union employees of color. So in our attempt to address this issue, I don't know how we also maybe address just some of the lack of pipeline and diversity issues in unions. That's something we've seen with even our longstanding worker training program. Our folks are still having issues getting on to unions. So I don't know what that looks like for New York, but wanted to lift that up.
Thank you. I appreciate that. This has been a really excellent conversation. I would hope that, first of all, let me thank Paul, Kendra, Kareen, and LG for volunteering to be part of this group that will work with the JTWG. If there are other questions or, you know, issues that you would like this delegation to address with the JTWG, please, you know, let us know and we'll make sure they have that information. And Adam and Karen will be reaching out to the four of you either today or tomorrow with the information on that meeting. Commissioner, have you joined yet? I'm hearing nothing, so let's continue on. Let's go to the advisory panel recommendations. So again, as we discussed earlier, each sub-work group is going to be presenting their recommendations to the full panel before the March 18th meeting. The work is underway, and I know the subgroups, many of you have received drafts, and I hope you're providing comments so that we can incorporate those issues and opinions into the documents that are being prepared. One of the things that we're doing now is that we're going to be going over the first draft set of recommendations, and that is going to be on electrification. So Adam, I think you're up to discuss the model, and please let us know as you hear Adam's presentation what works and does not work in terms of what's being presented here, and any additional suggestions you may have for enhancing what will ultimately be presented to the full CAC sometime in April. Adam?
Thank you, Ron. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ron, and thank you to all the panelists. As many of you know who have been involved, the Electrification and Fuels subgroup has been meeting to develop ideas for policies that will support the greater adoption of these cleaner alternative fuels in the transportation sector. These recommendations are focused on the transition to zero-emission vehicles, including both electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. We are still developing recommendations regarding other alternative fuels, so stay tuned for that. The recommendations that we have to present today are around two similar but distinct primary strategies. One is regarding switching to 100% zero-emission light-duty vehicles, such as passenger cars, SUVs, and light trucks. And one is regarding switching to zero-emission medium and heavy-duty vehicles and non-road vehicles. These are two of the strategies we think will have the greatest impact on overall transportation emissions, but these alone are not going to achieve our 2030 and 2050 goals. We will need contributions from the other policies under consideration, as well as the ones that are focused on system efficiency and other alternative fuels. So as we hear more from the other subgroups that are focused on public transportation, smart growth, system efficiency, and the other policies around other alternative fuels, I think that will really round out the picture and help us see how we can, through all those policies, get to the goals for 2030 and 2050. Next slide, please. So there's a lot on this slide, and all these slides are pretty jam-packed, but this is the template for the Climate Action Council that we've been asked to put together. So hopefully we can get as much information about these policies through to this group and then to the Climate Action Council as possible through this format. So this slide really expands on what was on the previous slide. As I noted, policies that we can adopt to move us toward 100% ZEV sales, such as adopting California's anticipated ZEV regulations, are some of the most effective at reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. They can come with a significant price tag, but will soon save consumers money over the life of their vehicles, as the upfront purchase price and the total cost of ownership declines. And they also generate large benefits in terms of public health. There are ways to reduce the cost to New York State through revenue neutral programs like a fee bait. There are a number of challenges that remain to achieving these ZEV goals, including a lack of consumer awareness of the technology and potential electric grid impacts. But we believe that these can be addressed through well-designed programs and coordination with private partners. I'll pause there for a moment. Any feedback on from the panel on the content of this slide or questions? I'll get into some more details.
Yes, it's LG. It seems like in the points that are made under at the bottom of this chart, there's a couple of references to the potential new burdens on utilities. But, you know, the flip side is, which I don't see mentioned here, is that the utilities are going to sell a hell of a lot more power, and which is going to help their bottom line substantially, I would imagine. And so it seems to me that there needs to be kind of a balancing of interests here. So, for example, we have heard that the cost of electricity for electric buses in New York City are really high, and that's addressed in point number three under possible mitigants. But I don't think this ought to be one-sided. I think we ought to have an understanding that there are sort of opportunities here for mutual benefits and responsibilities and obligations.
Thanks, LG. That is a good point. You know, we are working to set up a meeting with a group with the power generation group and also with a group of utilities to discuss some of these points. But you know, the flip side of that too, in New York, there is a decoupling of kilowatt-hour sales for utilities and revenue. So it's not exactly going to be, you know, how an oil company would see, you know, selling more petroleum is an unmitigated good for them. You know, for a utility, it's not exactly that same relationship with their bottom line. In New York, at least.
That's right, Adam. The actual sale of throughput doesn't fall to the bottom line for utilities in New York. There will be investments that they will need to make in the secondary distribution system in particular, and possibly in the bulk transmission system as well, to accommodate the new load. And some of that does build their rate base. But as a general matter, the increase in net revenue actually puts downward pressure on electric rates for all ratepayers. So the net economic impact of moving to electricity as a fuel for transportation is going to tend to lower electric rates across potentially and probably, given the way that the New York Public Service Commission is highly likely to look at this, it should lower electric rates for all ratepayers.
Hey, Paul, I don't want to belabor this, but some of this is policy related. We've been approached by national organizations representing service station dealers and also that other large organization nationally that represents convenience store operators. They don't want electric utilities involved in this business at all. And that is to say, they don't want electric utilities investing in charging stations, and they want federal prohibitions to prevent it. And I don't know where that's headed. I don't think we're going to support that. But, you know, they're trotting out all kinds of claims about how the cost to the consumers are going to go up, as to ratepayers will go up if electric utilities are allowed into this space. So,
look, I'm not talking about necessarily the electric utilities owning the charging stations. This is about what in New York is already underway through the Make Ready order that was passed in May of 2020. It is the upgrades for reliability purposes and for ensuring that there is a managed charging capability. But the electric companies have an obligation, if someone needs to be able to use electricity, the utilities in this country have an obligation to serve them. And you know, I'm aware of what these national organizations that you're talking about are saying, and I just think they have their facts wrong in many instances.
So I have a different question.
I do want to...
Bigger picture? Sure. All right. So in your description here, because we've been talking a lot about this, right? And I know you alluded to the California car standard. I mean, do we want to be more explicit here that the transition to 100% light duty vehicle sales by 2035, right? With the objective being, you know, having sort of a mostly complete transition to zero emission light duty vehicles by 2050. I mean, can we be more explicit here, or are we, you know, reluctant to do that for some reason?
why don't we actually, that's a good transition to the next slide.
Happy to help out, Em.
Sure. great. So we get into a lot more of the details of the types of policies that really make up this strategy on this slide. And so, you know, there's really a suite of policies needed. As Julie mentioned, the California Advanced Clean Cars rules are one element of that, and that would help us target 100% of sales being zero emission vehicles by 2035. I think general modeling and assumptions about the life of the typical life of vehicles, light duty vehicles, being in the 15-year time period, gets to just about 100% of the light duty vehicles on the road being zero emission vehicles by 2050. There's also a need for other supporting policies here, such as clean fuel standard that treats electricity as a clean fuel. Incentives for vehicle purchases, especially for low and moderate income buyers, investments in EV charging infrastructure, and utility rate design adjustments. These policies have been selected to address the barriers mentioned on the previous slide and additional barriers holding back ZEV adoption. I'll pause there give everyone a moment to take a look at this list and let us know if you have questions or suggestions for additional strategies.
That was very helpful. I still think it would be valuable, depending on how we're presenting this on the previous slide, that makes it more clear that's the goal. I think one other item, and I know this is even further in the weeds, is trying to identify what those sort of medium-term goals are. You know, I know there's a lot of question about whether or not, you know, what exactly the current ZEV MOU requires. But I feel like we need to start looking at how many ZEVs we need to have on the road by 2030 to help meet those targets, and what those greenhouse gas emissions would look like.
Yeah, Julie, along those lines, the pathways report that you know, we saw, you know, a few months ago identifies, I think, 60-70% of new sales by 2030 is what is needed to be on pace for achieving our emission reduction goals. And so that is somewhat aligned with the trajectory to 100% sales by 2035. But yeah, we you know, if the path forward here is adopting the California standards, we have to adopt the standards as they adopt them. They're not adopted yet. And, you know, that'll enable us to see what is the, you know, that 2030, you know, sort of point in the progress of those regulations. And do we need to, you know, sort of rely more on some of these complementary strategies you see here to achieve the level of deployment that we need?
Got it.
Adam and Jared, I had a quick question. Maybe this is already spelled out in the ZEV MOU or in where ZEV, the term zero emission vehicle, is coined. So is that looking at the life cycle emissions of the vehicles, including the fuel source, including the electricity? And do we need to add here another row to ensure that the electricity is renewably generated to match the new electric vehicle sales? So that way we can get true zero emission vehicles on the road.
So, hey, Adam, maybe I'll take that. Sure. So, Demetris, the CLCPA requires a zero emission electricity system by 2040, and a system that's 70% renewable by 2030. And it's the power generation panel that is really charged with, you know, making sure the supporting policies are in place to achieve that. But, you know, and they're, you know, they're responsible for looking at the emissions from the electricity sector. So I think for our purposes, we do assume those vehicles are zero emission from a transportation sector perspective.
Got it. Yeah. So we take that as a baseline that we will have renewable electricity, and then from there, we're looking at the vehicle side and introducing that into the market and in the transportation sector. So,
right.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, why don't we move to the next slide? So, ensuring that light duty ZEV adoption increases in disadvantaged communities will require targeted policies. Incentives should focus on these communities and should promote ways to create a robust local economy around ZEVs, including new job types tied to these vehicles. And I think the previous discussion that was a really informative way to broaden our ideas around how to do that and what's needed to make that happen. It's also important to note that the regulatory actions being considered, such as the clean cars rules, are aligned with those under consideration in other states as well, including other Northeast states and obviously California. And that's important because it can help minimize the interference and confusion with private sector partners and minimize the regulatory burden on those partners if they are programs that are multi-state programs or being adopted more broadly. So I'll pause there again for feedback.
I just want to express the appreciation that, you know, putting disadvantaged communities sort of front and center is really important, and recognizing that we need to pay a particular attention in that area is critical. So thank you for that.
I just want to make one quick statement. When you talk about disadvantaged communities as well, there are many communities. Some may be considered disadvantaged, some not, but they are where you have single-family homes without garages. And the infrastructure solution for those communities and for, you know, a large section of our inner city and urban communities is going to be a significant issue there as well. So they may or may not fall in terms of disadvantage, but there are, it's just the way that the housing structure is built to the point that, you know, they just won't be able to plug in at night like you would if you were in a garageable community.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. That's a really good point. Home charging, you know, for early adopters has been relatively easy because most of them have garages and can plug in at home. But as we get to a broader set of households that are looking to get involved with alternative with electrification and zero emission vehicles, we are going to run up to against a larger and larger percentage of households that don't have access to home charging. New York State has a higher percentage of people without access to home charging than most other states, if not all the other states. Certainly a large portion of the New York City metro area doesn't, and other cities in across the state fall into the same boat. So that is a key consideration, and how do we make EV charging accessible and hydrogen fueling for those vehicles as well.
Yes, Jared, just one thought. I think, you know, that's a great point that Steve raises, and I think it's really related to the point I think that LG raised about, you know, the convenience store operators and the like. You know, we could be transitioning to some extent to more of a, you know, gas station type experience in the long run, where charging is very fast and you pull into a convenience store, you know, occasionally with your, you know, 500 mile range vehicle to get a charge the same way you pump gas. And, you know, so, you know, part of the answer to the challenge that Steve raises is how quickly does that technology development take place? The speed of charging, the range of batteries that enable that kind of system to be really the you know, perhaps the primary charging system.
Why don't we move on to the next slide?
Hey, Adam.
Go ahead.
Before we move on, I think one of the things we should do is on the just transition portion of this slide, a number of really good points were made earlier in the conversation about need for additional training in the area of STEM and other, you know, preparations to ensure that the workforce is trained. We do have, you know, a statement that workforce development in disadvantaged communities, but I think the conversation we had earlier took us to a different level, and I do think we should incorporate that in there. It could be a sentence, you know, it doesn't have to be large, but get into the specific type of, you know, training and, you know, the need for, you know, the knowledge, I guess, of electricity and how components work and the coding and that kind of stuff. So we can talk offline about that, but I don't want to, dismiss the conversation that took place.
And Ron, on that point, you know, of course, we would also, you know, bring in any input from the conversation with the Just Transition Working Group as well. So this is really a preview, a first draft of what we showed to the Climate Action Council at a meeting, you know, currently scheduled for April.
Okay, that's definitely will be updated. Okay, so moving on to the second strategy focused on zero-emission trucks, buses, and heavy equipment. And so this is focused on shifting those types of vehicles to zero-emission technology, similar to the previous one. The market for these technologies is currently relatively early in its development, but shows great promise, and many have already found ways to make these vehicles economically viable. There is a huge public health benefit to electrifying these types of vehicles, especially in disadvantaged communities, which have historically been hotspots for truck and bus emissions. Some of the key barriers to address include high upfront costs and the cost of charging and fueling infrastructure, as well as a general lack of data on performance. I'm happy to pause here, or we can dive into the next slide, which gets more into more of the more details on the specific policy measures being considered. Why don't we move on to the next slide? So many of the policy approaches for these vehicles are similar to the approaches for light-duty ZEVs, but there are some differences. So there are different regulatory frameworks for trucks and buses, such as the California Advanced Clean Trucks Rule and the Advanced Clean Fleets Rule. And New York State would seek to adopt the relevant policies related to these vehicles. So the Advanced Clean Trucks Rule is a ZEV sales mandate that is in place in California, and several other states are planning to adopt. There are also fuel-related policies, such as Clean Fuel Standard that we spoke of earlier. And, you know, I think there's an understanding that those will be even more important for medium and heavy-duty vehicles, especially if hydrogen plays a significant role in this part of the transportation sector. They can help bring down the upfront cost of both vehicles and charging and fueling stations, which is critically important. But I think it is important to point out that the operating costs can be significantly lower than the cost of diesel vehicles, or significantly higher depending on the utility rate structures and the costs associated with the charging and fueling of these vehicles. Upstate especially, the costs can be significantly lower, and it does present a significant opportunity for saving money in the transition to zero-emission vehicles. So there are financing entities that are very interested in getting involved with this and see a real path toward saving significant costs from the maintenance and operations of these vehicles. There are also opportunities for New York State to lead by example and prioritize clean trucks in state procurement and contracts, as well as opportunities to require greater ZEV use at facilities like ports, where the state has a little bit more control over who enters and has access to those sites. So I'll pause there, and please feel free to offer feedback on these types of policy options.
Adam, in an earlier conversation, a representative from the Port Authority, and I apologize, I've forgotten her name, expressed some enthusiasm for that last bullet point, and it would be great if we could mention airports there, if she's still supportive. And
sure. Yeah, I think that was Christine. And yeah.
Yes. That's right. You know, these slides are very high level, so I'm trying to figure out what some of this actually means. And so under the bullet, charging and fueling station investments, and then it references other key stakeholders, fleet users. Do you mean fleet owners? Who do you mean by fleet users? Sorry.
Good question. Yes, vehicle owners, which may or may, you know, many vehicles of this type are leased, and so yeah, the operators, the fleets and the vehicle operators, but also the vehicle owners. So we can certainly adjust that terminology if that's not quite precise.
So based on data we've discussed earlier, the ZEV purchase incentives here may end up being prohibitively expensive, at least with respect to the kinds of trucking that, for example, that is done over long distances, but may in fact be a manageable proposition for fleets, large fleets that are serving ports and airports, for example, in a relatively small or short distance duty cycle. So I just want to reinforce the fact that it may be possible to scale the incentives issue in ways that focus first on, you know, things like ports and airports, which also gets at an environmental justice issue, a community issue at the same time. I don't know whether all of that is sort of packed within some of these bullets, but I just wanted to make that point again.
Thanks, Elsie. Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot more that can be said about all of these, and this is meant to be a high-level discussion. But I do think that, you know, targeting incentives and thinking about where which types of vehicles are going to be most ready to be rolled out in zero-emission formats soonest is going to be really helpful in trying to understand how do we get to these aggressive goals, but also how do we do it at a reasonable cost.
Well, I think I would like to weigh in on the port issue eventually, but somebody else, it looks like they're ahead of me. So, go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. I mean, in some airports, airlines own some of the ground support equipment. They usually do own some portion of it. A number of times the airport owns a portion of it, a significant portion, because they offer a lot of ground support equipment. So there are differences there in terms of ownership and operation, number one. Number two, as we've discussed before, at airports, there then is the issue of federal preemption if what the state tries to do gets into operation of aviation and potential limitations of it. And whereas California has unique authority to set requirements for non-road sources, and New York, as you guys know, can copy those under the Clean Air Act. Those are the types of things, but it can be very difficult to then say you thou shalt do X or Y with your fleet, at least as long as you haven't taken into account whether that then interferes with aircraft operations and service. And just finally, there are a number of pieces of ground support equipment that are electrifiable, and our members have been doing that. But there are some that still are not amenable to electrification in a reliable way, particularly in the cargo sector. So that has to be sort of a phase-in process when that gets worked out.
I don't think anybody is talking about, Nancy, a requirement that would impact airline operations. But I think it is perfectly reasonable to start thinking about the kinds of requirements for equipment that airlines, if they own that ground equipment, which I know many of them do, would have to meet in order to continue to operate at that airport. So I don't think that's preempted as long as...
Well, that would definitely LGB preempted. If somebody's saying you can't operate at the airport without using this equipment that is necessary to be able to have air service. So that's my point. It's not that it can't be crafted in a certain way, but you can't have blanket edicts on what ground support equipment can or can't do.
For example, you can't use ground support equipment in ways that cause excessive pollution at an airport. Those are rules that airports themselves often inflict. But maybe you and I ought to take this conversation offline and try to see if we can resolve it. I don't think that preemption is as blanket as you're suggesting.
I'm not saying it's blanket. I'm saying you have to carve what you're doing around that. And there are federal requirements for the emissions of the ground support equipment. And those ground support equipment has to meet those. You are correct that airports and airlines can also work out additional provisions for managing the ground support equipment, but there can't be thou must electrify everything today or tomorrow because you would stop the service, for example, of aircraft, and you might not be able to actually service certain aircraft, and it would be preempted.
I don't think issuing a requirement that imposes an obligation like that tomorrow morning is even on the table here. I agree with you. But it's a goal that you work toward over time and create an understanding on the part of everyone operating at the airport that by a date certain, they will have to transition their equipment. But I think we're getting closer to agreement here.
Christine offered, I don't know if you guys saw this in the chat, but Christine did offer to have an offline discussion specific to zero emission ground service equipment at airports. So that might be a conversation worth following up on. And she mentioned she had to leave.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. And we'll also include our actual ground support equipment experts in that who work for me.
So before we got on that conversation, I was going to say... totally different topic. I think it's important to note here, like Adam, you kind of alluded to this, right? There is likely going to be a longer lead time on being able to move to full zero emission technologies for this medium and heavy duty category. So I do think it's important that we make sure that we're providing the right tools and incentives, which you have proposed here with things like a clean fuel standard to move people off or onto, you know, less polluting, both from a carbon perspective, but also from a PM, NOx, benzene, toxins type of fuels as quickly as possible. So we're starting to gain some of those benefits while we're ultimately shifting towards full zero emission. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thanks, Julie. Yeah, I know we've had some initial discussions about policies to support other alternative fuels and what those might look like with the subgroup. And I think those discussions need to continue and we'll be putting something together like this for those as well.
Adam, it's Kendra.
Some of that can come through things like a clean fuel standard. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I apologize. Just a couple thoughts on this. The charging and fueling station investments under your key stakeholders, I think that needs to be expanded because as we've talked about before with the trucking industry, they're not always coming back to a home base. I mean, they're going to need to have access to charging infrastructure on road. So I think we have to look at potentially pulling DOT into the conversation as it relates to their rest areas, thruway authority, and also there's actually an association, the National Association of Truck Stop Operators, and so some of the privately owned truck stops may need to be part of that discussion as well. And it does tie into, and I apologize for sounding like a broken record, but it does tie into the other concern that I've raised in terms of the lack of available truck parking that we have, because we do have challenges today where there just isn't enough space, and unfortunately that's why we end up with trucks parked on the shoulder of roads and, you know, in areas where we may not necessarily want them, because they just don't have the ability to find parking. And if we can't find parking today, where are they going to park in order to charge in the future? So I think those are considerations as it relates to the subcharging and the fueling station investments that need to be added in terms of your stakeholder discussions. On the, I know you'd mentioned, you know, the ability to maybe fast track some of this through state procurement and contracts. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I would just raise the issue of the MWBE requirements as it relates to that, because I think that is a group that is going to be resource challenged in terms of making investments in electric vehicles or lower emission vehicles as well. So just, you know, consider that as part of that discussion. And then following up on the incentive, and I know we've talked about this on other calls, and I've been having discussions and reaching out and trying to get information in terms of truck financing. And what I'm finding is there is not a lot out there currently, nor have they really been starting to talk about it in terms of financing zero emission or alternative fuel vehicles. Some cases are larger carriers that are testing, such as UPS and Wegmans and FedEx. They're doing a lot of testing of these vehicles, and they're able to get financing. But if you're looking at just this typical smaller fleet that might be interested, they're finding it very difficult, in part because the financing institutions are concerned with resale value. You know, it's a high cost, and there's concerns there in terms of the ROI on that equipment. So I'm still working on it. I'm trying to get some information and pull some folks together for a discussion. But so far, what I'm finding is there's not a lot out there on a vehicle financing in terms of these institutions offering incentives for a lower emission vehicle purchases.
Thanks, Kendra. Those were a number of really important points. I would agree on the financing side. We've been working with some folks at New York Green Bank and some consultants who are experts on that field, and they've been telling us the exact same thing that you just said, that that the understanding the residual value is a big inhibiting factor to financing of these trucks right now, and also the scale at which you're doing it, it makes a big difference. So the UPSs of the world have that scale, and smaller operators don't, but we are, I know that they've been involved with the market-based the market-based mechanisms and financing subgroup, and I think that we're working on some policy ideas of how we can try to rectify some of that through that group. But I 100% agree that if we're going to do this, we need to really think through those topics. And I like your point on the infrastructure as well.
Thank you. Hey, Adam, on the for the smaller operators, both in the trucking industry and other transportation-related entities, can you elaborate a little bit more on how the utility rate design changes could help also impact operational costs?
Sure. So, first of all, I should point out that the story is different depending on the utility that serves you. Electricity costs are very different in at some of the municipal utilities versus Con Ed versus National Grid, and so it's not the same statewide. But for any of these fleet operators, whether it's the MTA with their thousands of buses or a small fleet. Some of the electric vehicles can charge at, you know, anywhere from 50 kilowatts to hundreds of kilowatts, depending on how they're charging and how it fits into their daily routine and Some vehicle depots can handle that. A lot of them can't and will require upgrades, service upgrades. Some of them may require the charging equipment for charging at those speeds can be expensive. So you're paying for that. But you're also paying, you know, based, most commercial rates have a demand-based element. So you are paying based on, in part based on the peak usage in a month over a 15 or 30 minute period. So that can rise very steeply when you switch to electric vehicles, and it can be something that people don't necessarily take into consideration when they're going through the process of purchasing. So I think the first step, number one, is to make people aware of the utility rate that they will that they'll be subject to when they have electric vehicles. If they may, sometimes they may be subject to different rates if they electrify a fleet and increase usage there quite a bit. But the second is really to help people understand what their alternatives are, what their options are. Because sometimes even just switching to a different rate type that's currently available can make a big difference. And managing the charging, making sure that as much of the charging is happening at off-peak times as possible, can make a huge difference for fleets. So one of the things that the utilities have started to do is offer some consulting services to fleets that are looking to electrify. And I think that this is a really great program and something that could probably be expanded going forward because, you know, as we discussed earlier, the folks who are maintaining these fleets and running operations for these fleets are not necessarily experts in the electric grid and electric rates and how to manage charging. So they need some training. There are also some companies that offer one-stop shop type solutions so that it's on the company, it's on the outside company to handle that. But there are options available that can handle some of these changes, but it is something that needs to be really well considered. Let's move on to the next slide. This is the last one on these topics. So, you know, as we discussed earlier, reducing emissions from trucks and buses is one of the most important things we can do to reduce criteria pollutant emissions and to make a difference in disadvantaged communities that have been overly burdened by pollution from trucks and buses so far, as well as, obviously, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. As we discussed earlier, there are job creation opportunities around clean trucks and buses, but there will likely be industry impacts from this transition and a large need for workforce training and new skills. And as we discussed earlier, we'll update the just transition portion of this slide based on the earlier conversation. And as with light-duty vehicles, the regulatory actions being considered are aligned with those under consideration in other states. There are a number of states that have signed the zero-emission vehicle MOU around medium and heavy-duty vehicles as well, which was just signed last year. And that's going to help minimize the interference and confusion with private sector partners as well, hopefully. Collective action can ease that. So, any further discussion on this topic?
Hey, Adam, it's Kendra again. Just kind of furthering my thought in terms of stakeholders as it relates to the build-out of infrastructure. As we're looking at the disadvantaged communities and knowing that they're often around high industrial areas or ports, I think maybe we need to look at where those facilities are and pulling them into the conversation as well, because we have a large amount of truck traffic in those areas. It might be areas that we should be expanding that charging infrastructure for when they're servicing, whether it's the ports or like Hunts Point, things of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense.
Is that the end of your presentation, Adam?
That's it for me.
Okay. Any other additional general comments on the presentation or the rubric for the recommendations? Okay, hearing none, we're gonna move on to the next section of our discussion. And basically what we would like to discuss is what are the plans for the next couple of weeks pertaining to additional expert input and research that the panel can do in support of the finalization of the recommendations under consideration. Adam, I think that you have been working on some policy briefs related to alternative fuel policies and BMT management. Can you give us a little bit of update on where that work stands and when it might be available for review by the panel members?
Sure. So CADMIS is finishing up the first draft of those by tomorrow, and we will be getting those to review. We'll get them feedback and make some revisions pretty quickly, but we're going to aim to get those to the panel as quickly as possible. I know that's something that's been long awaited.
Okay, and they were also preparing a sector-wide modeling, I should say, of GHG emission reductions, which I think aren't due until March. But can you give us an update on where that is and, again, status of sharing with the panel?
Sure. So we've been working with CADMIS to broaden the modeling that you saw the initial results from at a previous presentation about electric vehicles, and you saw a number of slides on the reference case. We're working with them to develop some policy scenarios based on the policy ideas that have been coming out of the subgroups and some refinement of that reference case. And we do expect to be able to share that later in March.
Okay. And we're not expecting any issues or, everything's on track.
That's still the timeline that I've been hearing from our CADMIS partners.
We're also in the process of trying to finalize a freight roundtable. Obviously, freight goods movement has come up as a critical aspect of greenhouse gas emissions. Right now, we're looking at representation from the American Association of Railroads, American Trucking Associations, Amazon and or Google. We're looking at some educational institutional participation from Syracuse University. Cargo Airline Association is another group looking at. Nancy, I'll defer to you, A4A. I know the airlines do actually carry cargo in addition to people. If this is something that your organization would like to participate in, and then possibly United States Postal Service.
Yeah, sure. We would like to. You're absolutely right. Virtually all the passenger carriers do carry cargo in addition, and in fact, Airlines for America has cargo members, all cargo members as well. FedEx, UPS, and Atlas.
That would be great. And again, not only is the cargo, many times essential, it's also high value cargo. So it's an area that we certainly want to make sure that as we're trying to balance the impacts on economic growth, we're getting inclusion from that part of the sector as well. So thank you for that. And then, Jared, you are working on a health and equity roundtable. Can you update the status of that?
Sure, Ron. Yeah, I've been talking with the market-based financing subgroup about potentially putting together such a roundtable. The idea came out of a conversation with the Climate Justice Working Group a few weeks ago. And you know, the idea that we have would be to explore the challenges and opportunities with regard to public health and environmental justice relating to market-based policies. We had a prior roundtable discussion on market-based policies and financing, and you know, one of the points we heard is that you know, research done in California that market-based policies themselves do not necessarily provide those benefits. And so what we, you know, what we're considering doing is exploring, you know, further what are the opportunities in program design to ensure that those benefits are realized, and to, you know, avoid a situation where the market results in adverse outcomes for disadvantaged communities. And so, you know, for example, those types of strategies would be targeting investments for disadvantaged communities, those kind of things. So we'd like to have, you know, more of a discussion about that, how to provide benefits in disadvantaged communities and how to reap public health benefits as well. So we've had some preliminary discussions among the subgroup about potential participants, and you know, I'll get the subgroup together next week to resume that conversation. And interested in any input that anybody else has, you know, from the panel in that regard.
Thank you, Jared. Moving on, next steps. Actually, before we you know, get to next steps, any discussion based on the discussions we've had today that anybody would like to bring up? I thought you know, the discussion that we had on the Just Transition Working Group, you know, the meeting coming up, and the questions that we want to engage them on, and even questions that we'll develop in the interim before that meeting, I thought that was an excellent conversation. I do want to thank Paul and Kareen and Kendra and LG for volunteering to represent the panel on behalf of the commissioner. You know, I think some very important points that we have not addressed yet addressed came out of that discussion. I think that was valuable. You know, Dimitri, I saw your text or your chat notation about you know, you working in the STEM industry and bringing some of those resources to bear to the discussion. I think it's very helpful. Certainly the need for discussion about how do we deal with individuals who typically didn't want to go to college, you know, and now that they could be disenfranchised because these will be higher tech, higher education requirements for employment. How do we balance a transition as we move from, you know, really a mixed set of vehicle propulsion types into the future, where we transition to all electric, and it will take several decades to basically transition out the internal combustion engine. So I think that was really good about what is the right point at which we start to implement some of these training programs. And I guess what I would say is that it's never too early, and we should start working based on the state level as well as the community level in terms of how we need to begin to balance the transition and the training necessary to be successful going into the next chapter of transportation history, because what we are talking about here is historical in terms of, you know, we went from steam engines to steam rail to railroads to interstates to we're going to, you know, the next great frontier in terms of how we move people and goods. So never too early to start that process of, you know, creating the education and experience opportunities, especially in disenfranchised communities. So anybody wants to add to that before we go to the next steps and open discussions, please do so. we're gonna take that as concurrence. So the next steps basically for us is we do have the open public meeting scheduled from 2 to 4, and that is on February 24th. So it's roughly a week away. We will certainly be soliciting their engagement in terms of where we are in terms of the materials that have been posted to date. We're going to be working on evaluating and refining the recommendations based on input. We've received input and we're continuing to receive input from the sub-work group panels. We want to elevate that to the panel members, and then ultimately we want to get the cross panel cross work group coordination going forward, so that we're positioned to present the recommendations for consideration to the larger CAC in April. We certainly need to summarize the benefits from all the draft recommendations and work towards aggregating the emissions impacts as well as the cost impacts and the feasibility for panel recommendations. And again, so that we can inform the larger CAC of, what are we recommending and what is the path or the resistance to moving forward. That brings us to the next, TAP meeting, which will be on March 18th. By then, we will have all of the slides. We heard from Adam on electrification. We will have all those slides for market-based policies, for public transportation, for smart growth, for fuels, to you for review. We will also look towards having a second TAP meeting scheduled in March to finalize those documents, so that we are positioned to make strong recommendations to the CAC when that meeting is scheduled in April. Anybody want to comment before we close out today's discussion? Commissioner, were you able to join? So again, we are experiencing difficult weather around the state today. So, thank you for your indulgence today. I think we're in a position to give you 8 minutes of your life back to, work on, other things. But I do think this was a very, very productive discussion. I think it was enlightening. And I do appreciate the level of engagement and participation by all the panel members today. And I did note that there not only were a number of questions and answers that we will put in the record, but also many of you provided some additional resources through the chat function. So I thank you for that. And again, please, everybody, stay safe, stay well. We appreciate your participation moving forward. Take care.
Good meeting, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you.